It is Monday, September the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, the far-right surges in Sweden's election.
A lot of this was a build-up that was taking place over the last few years with the rise, of course, of anti-immigration sentiment in Sweden.
U.S. and Saudi energy chiefs will be meeting today with Iran possibly on their agenda.
It may be all about Iran. I hope Iran is a big focus, but the U.S. needs to keep gas prices low.
Also ahead, a powerful Atlantic storm heading to the U.S., the U.S. Open, plus something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norton. Sweden appears to be headed for a hung parliament after an election on Sunday that saw support for the nationalist Sweden Democrats surge as one of Europe's most liberal nations turned right amid fears over immigration. After voting, the Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, warned against the country moving to the right.
But a decent democracy and social democrats and the social democratic-led government is a guarantee for not letting the Sweden Democrats, extremist party, a racist party, get any influence in the government.
And for more on the Sweden Democrats and the right-leaning voters in Sweden, we turn to Reuters' Saskia O'Donoghue.
The anti-immigration Sweden Democrats are vying to become the biggest party. And while that's unlikely, polls suggest they'll win less than 20% of the votes, that figure is still enough to render them as kingmakers. Johanna Lander is at the Reuters Stockholm Bureau.
The pretty straightforward centre-right bloc politics that has dominated Swedish politics for the last 100 years seem to come to an end, as no one will be able to form a government without the support of the Sweden Democrats. The problem is nobody wants to talk to them because of their troubled past. The Sweden Democrats were founded in the late 80s, in part by white supremacists, and in the early years their rallies drew skinheads. The current party leader, Jimmie Åkesson, has tried to clean up the party, but they have been rocked by numerous scandals and they have been forced to throw out numerous members because of racist statements online.
Sweden took in more asylum seekers per capita than any other country in Europe in 2015, magnifying worries about a welfare system that many voters already believe is in crisis. Sweden Democrat leader Jimmie Åkesson has promised to sink any government that refuses to give his party a say in policy, particularly on immigration. But with some kind of cooperation between parties in the centre-left and centre-right blocs the only other alternative, and with both options unpalatable to the traditional players, forming a government could take weeks.
That is Reuters' Saskia O'Donoghue. In Sweden, an influx of 163,000 asylum seekers in 2015, the most in Europe in relation to the country's population of 10 million, has polarized voters and fractured the long-standing political consensus in Sweden. And with almost all the districts in Sweden having reported by now, the ruling center-left Social Democrats and Greens and their left party parliamentary allies had 40.6% of the vote, while the opposition center-right alliance was at 40.3%. VOA's Victor Beatty asked scholar Benoy Kapmark, a senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies at Australia's RMIT University, for his read on the election.
A lot of this was a build-up that was taking place over the last few years with the rise, of course, of anti-immigration sentiment in Sweden. In 2015, when something like 163,000 individuals, asylum seekers and refugees were accepted into Sweden, the rise in numbers, the spike of arrivals started to prompt questioning about whether Sweden, you know, with its immaculate social welfare state with its particular style of living could actually cope with these new arrivals. So what the Swedish Democrats have been doing, essentially, is to operate on this mistrust and this fear and build up a base from which it could actually launch its political aspirations. So it's, in a sense, it was expected that the Social Democrats and then the more moderates to the right, the more conservative moderates, as it were, would occupy the main terrain, but that in between lie this significant block of votes of the Sweden Democrats.
There are also concerns, I believe, among Swedish voters about the long-standing welfare state in the country. the difficulties they're having with health care issues. Does this also play a factor?
Yes, it all does. One of the comments, or one of the strategies, I suppose, of Jimmy Akison, the individual who's been behind the rise, as it were, and marketing, you know, of the Sweden Democrats, is that certain accepted and taken for granted notions, you know, the welfare state being one of them, the medical care that comes with that as well, is being challenged by the shock of the arrivals. It's just also the sheer number, and per capita, Sweden and along with Germany have accepted the most refugees and arrivals in Europe, and so this has also repeated itself in the German context as well. Also similar in terms of approaches to the welfare state, quality of living, and so on. So these are things that certainly played up very dominantly in the elections when it came to the campaign.
Akerson calls himself a kingmaker. Will he be? It appears both blocs are stiff-arming him.
Yes, what is interesting and relevant to, for example, other European countries where the far right has made gains. So, for example, in the instance of Austria and in Italy, the far-right populist parties have managed to have a representation in the cabinet. But both the center-left and the center-right, with their blocs, have said that they will not make an arrangement with the Sweden Democrats. But that remains to be seen. There'll have to be some kind of governing party in order, and there may have to be some arrangements made by the major blocs if they want to keep the Sweden Democrats up. But in a sense, Akerson has already gotten what he wanted, because he managed to, with his rhetoric and with his stance, already push the major party groups in Sweden to the right. He's already managed to, for example, encourage the Swedish authorities to increase border controls and to keep an eye on arrivals and so on. So he is already setting the agenda, whether he's going to be, you know, in government or not.
Is populism becoming mainstream in Europe?
It's becoming a very important response and counter to the accepted order of Europe for decades. It's become the popular to be anti-EU, it's become popular to be anti-Brussels, and it's become popular to be, as it were, anti-immigrant. So these are a combination of factors that explain the kind of, you know, this nonchalance that's been shown towards changes that have been taking place in Europe for some decades now. And so the result of this, and certainly the EU experiment, which is, I see, is central to this as well, because Akerson is also an EU skeptic, and part of that rise of EU skepticism, this is all part of a trend in Europe that's simply becoming stronger.
Is this something the European Union could consider a passing phase, or something that's worrisome to them?
Well, the EU, and this I think is a problem, the EU has attempted to write off, for example, certain populist spikes in Europe as a temporary phase. The European Commission is on record as saying, for example, that the various lurches to the right in certain European countries is simply a temporary phase. But I think it's fair to say that if a country like Sweden were considered to be the epitome, as it were, the high watermark of social democracy and acceptance and tolerance for refugees, then certainly this is something that should put them on notice.
Dr. Benoit Kampmark is a senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban and Social Studies at Australia's RMIT University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Energy Secretary Rick Perry will meet later today with Saudi Arabia's Energy Minister Khalid Al-Falih here in Washington. This comes as the Trump administration is encouraging energy-producing countries to pump oil at higher rates 2 months before it renews its sanctions on Iran's exports of crude. VOA asked Foundation for Defense of Democracies research fellow Benham Bentaleblou for his thoughts on the meeting.
Hopefully it's about meeting global demand for energy, as well as looking for ways to make sure that all those countries who are looking to reduce the amount of Iranian crude oil, as well as condensate and any other petroleum products, have sources from which they can buy those petroleum products from. We know that South Korea is looking to essentially get down to zero, or may have done so already. The question is, will other Asian consumers have access to petrol? And Saudi Arabia seems to be stepping up, given its increase in production.
We also asked if he thinks Iran will be the focus of the meeting.
It may be all about Iran. I hope Iran is a big focus. But again, the U.S. needs to keep gas prices low as Iran sanctions come into effect. I think there have been lots of headlines that actually have spooked gas prices in the past few weeks, I would say within 3.5-4 weeks. I think this is more temporary. Even if you look at the prices of oil, or even the prices of gas in the U.S. under the peak of Iran sanctions, they didn't breach some of the caps that people had kind of fear-mongered and thought they would.
Over the weekend, numerous people were killed in an aerial attack by Iranian forces. It was on the headquarters of the Iranian opposition, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, or KDPI, and a refugee camp in northern Iraq. We asked Talablu about the attack.
This is Iran feeling increasingly confident in its short-range ballistic missile force. Again, those are the more, at least militarily accurate, ballistic missiles that Iran has. Iran is basically been at war with the KDPI for a few years now. There was a cold peace that ended poorly. And Iran is increasingly confident in its willingness, feels increasingly confident about these ballistic missiles and has been using them to adjudicate regional disputes. If you remember, June or July 2017, Iran fired 6 short-range ballistic missiles at Islamic State positions in eastern Syria. Now Iran fired 7 short-range ballistic missiles at a KDPI base in northern Iraq. So I think the more Iran's missile power grows, the more likely it will be to use these missiles in regional disputes.
We also asked if the Kurds are considered a threat in Tehran.
I would say that this group in particular, the KDPI, has been a thorn in the Islamic Republic side basically since the regime itself was conceived of. Again, Iran, this state has been no friend to the Kurdish people, whether they're Iranian Kurds or Iraqi Kurds. The Islamic Republic instrumentally divided Iraqi Kurds through the Iran-Iraq War. There's a legacy of intra-Kurdish fighting during that war. And Iran has been looking to kind of tamp down any secessionist claim that exists there, as well as use the threat of secession to justify harsher policies in the region.
Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei urged Iran's armed forces on Sunday to increase their power, in his words, to scare off the enemy, as the country faces increased tensions with the U.S. His statement came just before Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard said it had fired those 7 missiles in an attack on the Iraq-based KDPI. When we asked Talablu about the Ayatollah's comments, he said the goal is to allow Iran, in his words, to continue to carry out bad behavior without reprisal. Benham Bentaleblou is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on the Voice of America.
Florence, the sixth tropical storm of the Atlantic Basin this year, intensified into a hurricane on Sunday that will rapidly gain force as it churns over the open ocean toward the eastern U.S. coast, with landfall likely in the Carolinas, that's the states of North and South Carolina, later on this week. Residents as far north as Virginia, which is contiguous to Washington, have been warned Florence poses a life-threatening coastal storm surge, as well as flooding from heavy rain on the inland. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper also urged his state's residents to get ready, noting the storm already was generating swelling waves and dangerous currents all along the coast. The governors of Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina have all declared states of emergency. VOA's Lori London gets an update from David Zielinski. He is a hurricane specialist at the National Hurricane Center.
We've had a NOAA Hurricane Hunter plane investigating Florence, and it's found that the storm is strengthening. It's now a hurricane with maximum sustained winds of around 85 miles per hour, and the plane also found that the pressure is dropping fairly quickly, which indicates that the storm is strengthening. We expect the storm to continue to strengthen and become a major hurricane on Monday, remaining a very dangerous major hurricane through Thursday, when it is expected to begin to approach the eastern U.S. coast. At this point, it's too early to try to pinpoint exactly where Florence may make landfall along the U.S. east coast. However, there is an increasing risk of wherever it does make landfall, a very dangerous, perhaps prolonged storm surge flooding along the coast. And Florence could be a very heavy rainmaker. It's expected to slow down once it reaches the U.S., and that could result in very heavy rains and a lot of freshwater flooding.
Now, you say it will likely turn into a major hurricane by the time it makes landfall. How much higher do you expect it might go?
Well, right now, Florence is only a Category 1 hurricane. However, we expect it to become a major hurricane, which is a Category 3 or higher, by tomorrow. Now, when storms get to that strength, there's always a lot of uncertainty in exactly how strong they are, and it's important not to focus too much on the exact number. But regardless, we expect it to be a dangerous major hurricane as it approaches the U.S. later this week.
Are there certain states you're particularly keeping an eye on that it looks like it's probably going toward?
Well, right now we're certainly focusing especially on anywhere between South Carolina through the Mid-Atlantic region. And part of the reason for that is, you know, the hurricane's not just a point. Mm-hmm. So even if right now our forecast calls for the center to perhaps threaten somewhere in the Carolinas region, certainly the rainfall threat, which could be very significant, is going to extend well away from the center. And you can even have storm surge along the coast well away to the center, especially to the north, where the winds will be pushing water onshore.
So if perhaps the hurricane made landfall in South Carolina, you're saying many, many states north of there will still be feeling the effects of it?
Potentially, yes. It is a little too early to try to pinpoint exactly the extent to which Florence is going to affect, you know, the states around where it makes landfall. But certainly it's not going to be just a problem for one town where it makes mm-hmm. landfall. It's going to be something that's felt across several states.
When a hurricane gets to be Category 3 or higher, that has to do with the winds?
That's correct. The category, or the intensity, is really only the peak wind. And that's the peak winds associated with the storm. And, you know, they're occurring over a very small area. So realistically, very few people, if anyone, are going to actually experience those peak winds. What most people are instead going to experience is prolonged, stronger winds that aren't necessarily 100 mile per hour plus winds that you'd have in the inner core, and especially the storm surge, which can extend well away from the center, and the heavy rain.
That's David Zielinski, a hurricane specialist at the U.S. National Hurricane Center. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Well, time now to turn to sporting news. At the U.S. Open tennis tournament, Novak Djokovic earned his 14th career Grand Slam title late on Sunday with a victory over Juan Martín del Potro. That was in the men's final. And on Saturday, Naomi Osaka won the women's title, but not without a lot of tensions between her opponent Serena Williams and a match official. Reuters' Grace Lee reports.
The U.S. Open women's final ended in chaos Saturday after Serena Williams suffered a mesmerizing meltdown on the court. Instead, 20-year-old Naomi Osaka clinched the title, becoming Japan's first Grand Slam singles champion. But her victory was overshadowed by a bizarre spat between Williams and an official. Umpire Carlos Ramos sent Williams into a rage after accusing her of receiving instructions from her coach, which isn't allowed. He handed her a code violation. That sent Williams off into a string of bad behavior. She was later slapped a point penalty for smashing her racket, then a game penalty after she called Ramos a thief for stealing her point. She accused him of sexism, saying she's seen men do far worse.
That is Reuters' Grace Lee. And now the Women's Tennis Association, the WTA, calling for equal treatment of all tennis players and coaching to be allowed across the sport in the aftermath of the U.S. Open women's final issues. As we just heard, Serena Williams was given three code violations by the chair umpire, Carlos Ramos. It was a 6-2, 6-4 loss to Osaka. And Williams and critics inside and outside tennis argue that she was not treated the same as some male players. The Women's Pro Tour agreed. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2006, members of the International Astronomical Union, the IAU, voted on a set of characteristics that define what makes a planet a planet. One of those traits required a planet had to be clear in its orbit, meaning it had to provide the greatest gravitational force in its orbit. Since the gravity of Neptune influences Pluto, the Kuiper Belt object could no longer be considered a planet, so it was demoted to dwarf planet status. Investigators from the University of Central Florida recently analyzed 200 years worth of scientific literature. They say only one publication from 1802 used the clearing orbit requirement to classify planets, which was later found to be based on disproven reasoning. The Florida researchers say what defines a planet should be based on its own fundamental properties rather than variables such as the dynamics of its orbit. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music. The 3 Degrees is an American female vocal group which was originally formed in 1963 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Although a total of 15 women have been members over the years, the group has always been a trio. The original members were Fayette Pinckney, Shirley Porter, and Linda Turner. Look Into My Eyes was an early hit for the group in 1965. Lineup of the 3 Degrees consists of Valerie Holiday, Helen Scott, and Freddie Poole. Holiday has been a member since she first joined in 1967, while Scott has been a permanent member since 1976, having previously been in the group from 1963 to 1966. Recently, they did a tribute album to their hometown of Philadelphia and covered a few popular songs like Love Train, originally a hit single for their close friends, the OJs, which reached number one on both the R&B singles and Billboard Hot 100 charts. The 3 Degrees often top the U.S. Hot 100 chart as featured vocalists on hit after hit, including what many consider their signature song, the highly acclaimed 1974 single, When Will I See You Again? Throughout the decades since they were formed in the 1960s, the 3 Degrees have always been well known for their soulful voices, those beautiful gowns, and fabulous stage shows. They're also known throughout the world and have been continuously touring for more than 40 years, and they're still out on the road touring to this day. Even today, they command audiences of 80,000 when they go to Britain. Can you believe that many people show up in Hyde Park? Anyway, got to tell you quickly here that Miss New York, Nia Imani Franklin, is the new Miss America. She was crowned on Sunday night. She said in her onstage interview that when she was small and she was among the minority students in her school growing up, she said her love for music and arts made her fit in, and congratulations to Nia. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you here. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, hoping you have a great Monday.
This is